time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Debbie Wagner. Debbie Wagner has been active in leading and working with a grassroots fight against a third runway at SeaTac Airport for over a decade. She is co-founder of the U.S. Citizens Aviation Watch Association, was twice elected president of Citizens Against SeaTac Expansion, and sat as administrative director of the Regional Commission on Airport Affairs. And she is here to talk about her book, Over My Head, An Activist Group Fights an Airport Expansion, a personal story of community, grassroots, toxic emissions, and far too many cancer deaths. Debbie, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
You're welcome, Mike.
So to start out, tell us, how did you get involved with the issue of SeaTac Airport?
Well, in approximately 1994, I had an experience in my home where a jet airplane went over. Early in the morning, it was a military aircraft. It was heavy fog. It was making a lot of noise with powering its engines up and down. And it's typical for that type of aircraft to do that. But I'd heard planes going over before, and this was something different I hadn't heard before. It scared the living crap out of me. And I started to ask questions about why that happened, what was going on. I got the runaround. I got told that it was something that they were allowed to do, to take the military aircraft at SeaTac in an emergency situation. I didn't find that comforting, and I was pushed into looking into other issues that were involved with my home and my neighborhood all of a sudden being designated a flight path and hundreds of aircraft going over my house every day. I hadn't noticed that before, and it started to concern me. So I went to the community meetings that they had around the area for Citizens Against SeaTac Expansion and got in touch with a few people that had a lot of information. I ended up getting a pile of emission reports from airports around the country and started looking into that. And I was very shocked at what I was reading. And as an outgrowth of that, I started attending more meetings, meeting more people, and talking to people. It seemed to me they were suffering, and people were downtrodden. They were being abused daily with the noise and emissions from the airport, and I wanted to find out more. And as I got on a learning process and got involved with the citizens group, I started learning that we are kind of excluded from a public process where our voices are not really heard. That's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I wanted people to know that there's this group of really great people, really nice people, who are just like everybody else, trying to live their lives, work, you know, own a home, invest in their future, whose lives are being shattered and they are being abused constantly, and it's just taken for granted that they're going to be okay, and people don't know they're out there. They don't know how much they're suffering, and people need to know about it.
So tell us about the communities that are being directly impacted by the airport, and touch on, you know, the common thing that you always hear in the papers and whatever was, well, why did you people move next to an airport and now you're complaining
about
it?
Yeah, that's the one issue that I tried to spend a lot of time with in my book. Reporters, I've been interviewed a number of times because I've been the president of the Citizens Group and I worked with the Regional Commission on Airport Affairs. And I've also networked with other groups across the country. And one of the questions that reporters typically ask is, so what would you say to the question of why did you move there? You knew there was an airport there, so why did you move in? Well, the main focus of the concern with people is usually noise issues. And some people think, well, I could probably live with a little bit of noise, you know. So there are people that move in and they think they can handle it. A lot of these people find out later they can't. People have been living in homes that are insulated, and they find that the noise has not really been reduced enough to satisfy their needs. A few loud noise events that the airport averages over time that disrupt their lives. They're told that, you know, these are average amounts that aren't really that bad, and the data looks good, so they aren't really disturbed. When they're being awakened at 4:30 in the morning, they're told this is an average, it's not that bad, you're okay. So they really have no voice either. But the thing about our area is we're one of the oldest communities in Seattle. It dates back to the late 1800s, where Sunnydale School, which is the oldest school in the Highline School District, was opened in 1882, which predates the invention of flying. Some of our schools were built while the airport was still a farm. Our area was the most populated by acre in the 40s, before the airport was even introducing jets into service, and when it was still just a tiny little urban general aviation airport with very few flights. In the 60s, when jets were heavily introduced into commercial service, people started to get upset. And these people are living in homes in areas that were already established. So when they say, why'd you move in? Well, we were there first. And I would ask, why are there homes there? If people aren't supposed to live near airports, why do we have communities? And then as the airport continues to grow and expand and create worse problems for the people living nearby, they keep saying it's getting better, we're getting quieter, we're a good steward of the environment, we've converted some taxis to compress natural gas, so everything should be okay. While at the same time, people are saying, well, why did you move there? So what is it? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it safe? Is it not? And in actuality, nobody is talking about the emissions. And these emissions are expected to have a ground-level effect on people that are 2,500 feet and below the flight path, which extends 12 miles out from a runway end for landing aircraft, which, you know, Department of Commerce in 1970 said it goes out to Eastgate in Bellevue and out to Alki Point in West Seattle. So you've got a very large group of people, well over 100,000 people, that are being affected daily by emissions that nobody's talking about. And these emissions are extremely toxic. They are criteria pollutants that are full of carcinogens that when they get on your skin, they fall on your head. They get on your skin and they're absorbed through the body. And, you know, cancer develops over time, so they're not going to get sick right away, maybe 20 years down the road, maybe less, depends on an individual's predisposition. They're potentially a victim. And, you know, when people say, why'd you move there? Well, nobody says that to someone who's poisoned by a toxic chemical plant. They don't say, well, of course you're poisoned by a toxic chemical plant. You move next to it. I don't know why they use that argument for us. It's like separating out classes of people. You're stupid and you move there, so you get what you deserve. Nobody should be allowed to kill somebody else with their impacts. It's just not allowed in this country.
So talk more about specifically what people are being affected with, the emissions that are coming out of these jets. How do they compare to, for instance, stuff that comes out of, let's say, automobiles? And aren't these regulated?
No, it's not regulated. Airports are exempted from regulations. So there's nothing compelling them to develop cleaner engines. There's nothing saying, oh, the emissions are too much from the airport. You have to reduce it. Nobody's regulating it. Nobody's required to monitor it. Nobody's enforcing any regulations on it except for a boiler at the airport that produces heat. The jets are exempted, and they're huge. They're a huge major source of air pollution in our region. And in my opinion, I think that the jets are responsible for producing emissions that could even be causing us to violate the federal standards from time to time. I know the regulators would argue with me that that's probably not the case, but nobody's nailing it down because, again, they're exempted. It's not monitored. It's not controlled. The airport doesn't have to report its emissions like other industry. And like if the airport were a smokestack, it'd be shut down. Because of the amount of benzene that the airport emits annually and formaldehyde and other regulated pollutants like that, if Puget Sound Clean Air Agency were to permit the airport, it wouldn't be able to do so because of the high rates of emissions that the airport produces. And again, these are mostly produced by jets. The airport typically claims that the pollution problems around its area are from cars coming to and from the airport. But to cite an example of the difference between the amount of emissions emitted by cars and emitted by jets, for nitrogen oxides, they are part of what produces ozone. It's nitrogen oxides, which is combined with hydrocarbons and heat, sunlight, time, and distance, which creates ozone. The airport produces nitrogen oxides at a rate of 21,530 cars for each DC-10 takeoff. Carbon monoxide is equal to the pollution levels. Well, one DC-10 idling for 10 minutes produces the carbon monoxide levels equal to 8,000 cars. One 747 idle for the same time period produces sulfur oxides equal to 500,000 cars. The rates are tremendous. And when you have thousands of jets operating at an airport each day, the emission levels are just huge. They're equal to millions of cars on the road. So if the airport were to say, yeah, cars in the area are the problem, their inventory of 500 tons of emissions from all cars in the area is dwarfed by the 10,000 tons per year of jet-produced emissions of those same pollutants.
So when they're making efforts to, like, clean up the taxi fleet there, that's like nothing compared to, that's like a drop in the bucket, literally.
It's a notable effort. It's something that is a good thing to do, but it is just a drop in the bucket for comparison to what the jets are producing. Now, you know, you could convert a few taxis to compressed natural gas, but if you add three jets to your fleet, you've completely undone any reduction or goals or gains that you've obtained from the reductions in the cars, because the cars are really insignificant. Now, in 1995, when I was arguing with the regulators during the EIS process, well, the environmental impact statement that the port had produced, they had cars at a really high rate and jets drastically reduced for the emission levels that they predicted. And I couldn't understand why that had switched so much from previous analysis. What they had said was cars, they kept focusing on cars as being the emission problem around the airport. I think they wanted to sidetrack the attention off the jets for the time being, but as contemporary to the SeaTac EIS, there was another very comprehensive, well-documented report that was released by the Environmental Protection Agency for Midway Airport in Chicago, which had a quote in it that said, "The cancer risk increase in the communities around Midway Airport is 99% due to the jets, and, of course, 1% due to cars and other industry in the area, and that is expected since cars are insignificant." And I quoted that several times in arguing with the regulators that were working on the environmental impact statement and the airport itself, and those kind of things were dispelled and ignored. People were taking the EIS as the most comprehensive, wonderful document to date, and this other credible report was being ignored.
You talk about different key reports in your book, Over My Head. One of those, the first one was one put out by the Commerce Department, Technical Report Number 58.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was the one that estimated the area of pollution and the impacted communities in the flight paths. That was produced as a result of concern that communities had over the black smoke that they could see from the jet engines as they approached the airport. A lot of these types of planes are not in service anymore. They're Stage 1 and Stage 2 aircraft, and they've been phased out. But the visible black smoke that was creating soot in the communities was a concern. So they were looking at what areas were being affected. And this is the report that had the area of impact under a 2,500-foot ceiling as going 12 miles out from a runway end. This is where people are allegedly affected from the emission levels falling from the planes as they approach SeaTac. Now, they've said that since this time they've reduced the visible black smoke with what they called smokeless burner cans. But some groups in this country think the smoke has been colored cloud white rather than being reduced, and people in the flight paths still complain of sooty deposits on their properties. Someone had been quoted in an article that I had from some years back saying that when he hosed off the outside of his house, this sooty deposits washed off as oily black slime, which seems to give some credibility to the idea that maybe the soot has been colored, because eventually it does turn black. And when it settles on properties, it appears to be black sooty deposits. And this is the stuff that really concerns me, because in some of the Air Force studies that I've looked at, these sooty deposits can and may and possibly do contain PAH, which is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. They're little particles that attach to the soot. They're a byproduct of combustion of jet fuels. And PAH are some of the most carcinogenic compounds known to man. There are pyrenes and benzopyrene and fluorinthine and different types of chemicals that are considered to be extremely carcinogenic, and this is what can be absorbed through the skin. And my biggest fear is that when the jets are approaching the airport, there are public schools located in the flight paths, and these children are being exposed to these sooty deposits and potentially the PAH chemicals that are getting onto their bodies and being absorbed through their skin. At some point, the airport says, well, it's no different than car, truck, or bus emissions. It is different because the car, truck, and bus emissions are along main roads. Their pollution usually falls on the ground or is at a low level, and it's localized to the areas of impact. You don't have too many semi-trucks and buses driving through school playgrounds. But you have quite a few jets flying over playgrounds that are loaded with children that are running around playing happily, not knowing that they're being toxic crop dusted with these emission combustion byproducts that are expected to cause a cancer risk increase. It's terrifying.
Talk about another key study that you mentioned in you go into detail in your book, Over My Head. Our local Department of Ecology did a key study.
Yeah, in 1991. They estimated the emission levels from jets, and they came up with thousands of tons per year of criteria pollutants, and they had predicted that the airport would be violating a couple of federal standards, one for nitrogen dioxide and the other for particulates. And they also estimated that there were high levels of benzene in the communities, and that there were schools nearby, and they were concerned about the levels of benzene that the children might be being exposed to. Caused quite a stir in the community. People got very upset about it, wanted more studies done to find out exactly what areas were being affected and how.
All right. And what was, when the public got outraged about that, what was Department of Ecology's response?
Department of Ecology said this is just a screening, it's an overview, it's not really credible, we need better studies to try and figure out what's going on. That's a typical response. We get study after study, and it's always just scratching the surface. Nobody ever really wants to dig in and look closely. I think it's because they can't do anything about it, or they don't want to do anything about it. They don't regulate airports. Department of Ecology is exempted from being able to do anything. So if they do find out something terrifying, they can't really do anything. So they just scratch the surface. So as an adjunct to that report, the port hired McCulley, Frick, and Gilman to do an air quality survey. And they found that benzene was above the acceptable source impact level, which is the state regulation for new sources of toxic air pollution. If, like I said, it was a smokestack, it would have been shut down, or they would have had to install some scrubbers or whatever, best management practices to reduce the emissions to allowable levels, they found that for formaldehyde, benzene, trichloroethylene, a number of carcinogens were exceeding the acceptable source impact level in our communities.
Yeah, I should.
And that's expected to cause a cancer risk increase. So they bought out the Seattle Christian School, which was near the area where they expected the high levels of benzene. And it was removed to another area further from the airport. They said it was because Alaska wanted to put a facility there, but, you know.
So I know they bought out a lot of houses for the noise problem.
Yeah.
Are there other houses, businesses, whatever, been bought out from the pollution impact?
Well, a lot of the activists in the area think that the Riverton Heights neighborhood was bought out because of a high number of brain tumors in the community. There were several people that had a glioblastoma brain tumor in the area, and they felt that the airport bought out that area, which is not in the flight path and not in the direct noise zone where the port usually buys people out because of all these the high number of brain tumors. And subsequently, the State Department of Public Health was finally compelled to look at our zip code data for illnesses in our area and found that we had a 75% higher rate of glioblastoma brain tumors in our communities.
And as you pointed out before, the airport is a very large contributor to greenhouse gases. How does it compare, let's say, countywide and or statewide?
Well, they are producing almost a quarter of the King County total of greenhouse gas emissions, 4.2 million metric tons per year, and that was estimated in 06 with over 400,000 annual operations, or pumping over 2 million gallons of Jet A fuel each day at that point. And greenhouse gas emissions are a real important issue for a lot of groups presently because, you know, it contributes to global warming. These emissions were estimated for just carbon dioxide. It wasn't estimated for nitrogen oxides or methane, which also is a contributor to global warming. And, of course, the aircraft, jet aircraft produce quite a lot of nitrogen oxides as well. But this report also, I used the information from this report to send a letter to Governor Gregoire and our Attorney General McKenna, and asked them to sign on to as an amicus to a action that was begun by California to require EPA to regulate airports. I think this is a crux of the matter that EPA does not regulate the emissions at airports. You got a lot of people being exposed, tons of emissions that are not being controlled. And I thought it was a real good opportunity for our state to use this information as one of the maybe first or few states in this country that had even produced a greenhouse gas emission report. And our governor decided that at this time they are not interested in getting involved with the legal action with 10 other states that had joined on to try to get EPA to regulate emissions at airports.
And what is happening at SeaTac Airport, you believe, is happening at all other major airports in the U.S.?
I do, and it's because it's all the same planes. They go from our airport to O'Hare to, you know, LAX, Denver, and these emissions are being spread out in communities all over the country, and people, I think, need to know that they are being exposed to a lot of toxic chemicals every day from all these overhead aircraft that nobody's talking about.
And would it be fair to say that the communities that typically surround large airports would be middle and lower class communities?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it's a mixed group of people, mixed type of housing developments. There are really nice homes in our area, really beautiful areas. There were used to be many large farms. These homes and developments are, of course, devalued by the noise and being next to an airport, but still it's a mixed area, and I think that's typical around the country. If these areas are run down or if they are being turned into rental housing and losing the value. I believe it's typically because of the airport and the blight that airports usually bring to a community.
So, unfortunately, only a few minutes left. So, where are you currently in this battle with SeaTac and or the government entities that are representing it?
I'm still working with the U.S. group. I'm still networking around the world. I just recently was talking with John Stewart, who was the head of the HACAN group, who worked on the issue with Heathrow Airport wanting to expand with a third runway. They were able to beat that runway based on economics and global warming. And the economics was an interesting factor because they were able to show that a third runway at Heathrow would not provide the economic benefit that the airport was claiming it would provide. They had calculated that once all the exemptions and tax breaks and different types of government subsidies are added in, that it would actually bring a loss to the communities as far as an economic benefit. So that was very helpful in their victory in beating the third runway at Heathrow.
And before we went on the air, there was mention of a potential lawsuit that's in the works?
Yeah, there's a firm in Tacoma, Pfau, Cochran, Vertitas, and Kosnoff, that have taken on a case from a number of plaintiffs that are in the new flight path, who were originally told that the third runway would be a part-time, limited-use, bad-weather landings-only runway. And they woke up one day and were shocked to find, like I did years earlier, that they're now living in a new flight path that's being used all the time, and essentially they're in a war zone. And so they've also included in their complaint emissions and soot, which I think is significant because according to the airport, this is the first case on emissions that a group of people have brought against an airport. So I think it's groundbreaking. It's exciting. It's interesting to see what kind of arguments the airport can bring against the claim that the plaintiffs had, that they may be being injured by these, with the many credible reports that are out there that say they will be. There is a cancer risk increase for communities near airports. I think it's very exciting, and I'm anxious to see them have a really good turnout here.
All right. Very briefly, have local environmental groups helped you out on this issue?
There are some. There's a Waste Action Project, which had an expert, Greg Wingard, who did a lot of work on the water quality issues around the airport. He's a fantastic expert. He's been very valuable to our case group. He's trying to protect the vast aquatic resources that are located around the airport, the number of lakes and streams. These feed an aquifer that's sometimes used by various water districts around the area. These streams flow into Puget Sound. So his efforts are helping to reduce emissions that are flowing into water bodies that we all benefit from, that are a great estuary and resource for our entire region. And he's done a great job in trying to get the airport to be held accountable for fuel releases, glycol in the streams, fecal coliform, and a number of other dangerous pollutants they've released into the streams over the years. So it's good work that they do.
We're talking with Debbie Wagner. She is the author of the new book, Over My Head, An Activist Group Fights an Airport Expansion, A Personal Story of Community, Grassroots, Toxic Emissions, and Far Too Many Cancer Deaths. And you are doing a book signing today.
Yes, at Berrien Books. Mm-hmm. It's located at 824 Southwest 152nd Street in Berrien, and it's going to be at 1 this afternoon to 3. And I hope to see some people there and maybe answer some questions and get to know some of the people that may be in the legal action and wanting to get more information on what's been going on with emissions. And so I'm excited about that.
Very good. Well, unfortunately, with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.